She bent over the desk and took her time signing. She left behind a retainer and a phone number, and the scent of rose oil. Hey folks, how are you? This is Keith Tyler, joyfully bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sundowns of Arizona. I am so grateful you tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Libby Cudmore bring us our first story. It's called Enjoy the Silence. It's a cliche to see a woman with great legs and a nervous way of speaking enter a PI's office. I'd seen the Maltese Falcon. I'd read The Big Sleep, and yet Ms. Richmond was sitting in my blue chair like a dream, glancing at the door like she was afraid of who might come in. If it was an act, it was a good one. She had a ballerina's disposition and violet eyes, a silver fox fur collar, and a pair of heels that only professional girlfriends wear. She'd come up through the snow and up two flights of stairs in those. I was impressed.
"I'm having trouble getting in touch with a friend of mine," she said. "We normally meet on Wednesdays, but he never showed up. I called and left a message, but I haven't heard anything back. I just want to know he's safe, that's all."
"Any reason to think he isn't?"
"Well, it's not like him to miss one of our dates," she said. "I certainly don't want to stalk him, but he has a history of depression, and he's recently confided in me about some family troubles. I just want to know that he's all right. Is that something you could help me with?"
"Well, I'm not sure if a PI is the man to handle getting ghosted," I said.
"Women like me don't get ghosted, Mr. Wade," she said. She made my name sound like music.
She was either playing me for a knight or a sap, possibly both. "Give his name and address to my assistant at the front desk," I said, "and we'll see if we can locate him for you." She smiled and stood and held out her hand. I wondered if she wanted me to kiss it. I wouldn't dare. I caught a quick glimpse of a tattoo on her left wrist, a rose in full bloom. I caught myself wondering where the rest of her ink was, and I knew better than to ask.
"Well, that's a gorgeous coat," I heard Valerie say as she printed out her intake form. "Vintage?"
"Yes," she replied. "A gift from a friend. He had it relined for me, updated a bit. It's the only part of winter I'm enjoying."
She bent over the desk and took her time signing. She left behind a retainer and a phone number and the scent of rose oil.
"Do women who walk in here usually look like that?" Valerie asked when she had gone.
"No," I replied. I wasn't sure if she was a vision or a fever dream, something I might have imagined after falling asleep in front of a Turner Classic movie. At least Valerie saw her, too.
"Well, these days a woman doesn't wear Betty Page bangs. Well, unless she's a rockabilly scenester or a burlesque performer," she said. "And in her case, I'm going to guess some variation on the latter. Maybe the private kind?"
Ms. Richmond didn't mention that her friend was Kyle Fontaine, heir to the Fontaine radio fortune. He was probably on his yacht in Saint-Tropez or skiing in the Swiss Alps, out of touch in the way only the wealthy can be. But that also meant that I couldn't just drive up to his house and ring the doorbell. There would be a wall of housekeepers and managers and lawyers to get through first, and none of them would want a PI poking around in their business. Valerie filled me in on the details of the Fontaine family.
Plato Fontaine, a Civil War veteran, vowed to use his family's money to bring peacetime through music. He invested in a piano factory in Oneonta, 60 miles from here, then used that money to build the phonograph factory that later made radios. At one point, Valerie told me every drive-in in the Northeast used Fontaine radios. Production moved overseas in the 1990s, but the family still had their tendrils throughout Perrine. The daughter, Deborah, was president of the hospital board. Their oldest son, Andre, maintained the family business. But not a lot was known about Kyle, except that he was the youngest, a cryptocurrency trader, and a noted recluse. No boards, no foundations, no charity work except for a large yearly donation to the Perrine County Animal Shelter. I called the Fontaine Foundation and left a message with Giles, the assistant. I lied and told him I was calling from the high school and was hoping Kyle could come talk to my students. Giles assured me he would pass along my message and phone number and hung up without waiting for my goodbye. For what they were paying him, he didn't need to. Valerie had gone out for lunch when Kyle Fontaine returned my phone call. He sounded anxious. I told him I wanted to see him, wanted to verify that he was real before I made the call to Ms. Richmond. He could come here, or I could drive over there, his choice. I'd make it easy on him. Kyle arrived an hour later. He drove himself. He looked like he was only half a step ahead of a nervous breakdown. He was gaunt, with sunken eyes and wide hands that bounced and rattled at his sides.
What's this all about? He demanded. What's so urgent that it couldn't be done over the phone?
Had a client call in a welfare check on you, I said, passing him my card. Any reason my client needs to be worried about you? His eyes narrowed.
Who is it? He demanded.
I'm not at liberty to say, I replied. But I've fulfilled my end of the contract. You appear to be safe, healthy, and of sound mind. You're free to go whenever you'd like. He started to get up, then hesitated. He languished back in the chair, pressing his face against the fabric of the upper arm.
Was it Emma?
He asked. Even if I knew who that was, I couldn't tell him. I repeated my previous line, and he smiled dreamily.
Oh, it must have been her, he said. I can smell her perfume. Tell her I miss her. Tell her I will call her soon. I have another gift for her.
So she'd given him a first name, which she'd withheld from me. Or maybe she gave me an alias. I didn't know the backstory, and I didn't care. I had done a good deed, and would have a happy, rose-scented client. All that was left was to file the paperwork and collect the back half of my fee. But I wasn't ready to do that just yet. Any reason she might be concerned about you? He paused.
It's complicated, he said. And she's so very sweet. I was wrong to worry her. That's on me. Send the bill for your services to the Fontaine Foundation, Mr. Wade, and I shall pay it.
Well, I wasn't worried about who was paying the bill. I felt like an actor in a play I didn't audition for. I passed him my card and told him to call if he needed anything else. I didn't trust that look in his eyes, didn't trust the way his hands shook at his sides. I was hoping I was wrong. I was hoping he wouldn't call. In the end, he didn't. Saturday morning, I got up late, ran a sluggish 2 miles on the treadmill, tried my hand at the New York Times crossword puzzle, and gave up halfway through. I showered and shaved and made myself another cup of coffee. The whole world felt slightly crooked, and I couldn't figure out why. Around noon, I got a call from a private number. Something told me I'd better answer it. Even with a sob in her throat, Ms. Richmond kept her wire-tight composure.
"Mr. Wade," she said through tears, it's Kyle. He's dead."
I called Valerie and asked her to go into the office. She sounded like she had just woken up, but she agreed to go in. I might need her to look up information or post my bail, depending on how things shook out. Ms. Richmond gave me a room number at the Rudiger Hotel and told me to knock twice when I arrived. Against my better judgment, I obeyed. She opened the door, still in her fox fur coat.
"Thanks for coming," she murmured. I didn't know who else to call."
"You haven't called the police."
I wouldn't know what to say."
She opened the door a little wider, and I stepped inside. The room was a two-room suite with a cozy dinette corner and a fold-out sofa. The bedroom doors were closed, and the balcony doors were open just enough to let an ice-cold breeze in. It didn't smell as much like death as I thought it might. Or maybe I was just smelling her rose oil perfume above everything else. "What happened?"
I found him," she said, in the bedroom closet, hanging by his tie."
"Suicide?"
"Kyle would never," she said.
"You said yourself he had a history of depression," I said. "Sometimes our demons get the better of us." She let out a sob and sank into the sofa. I handed her my handkerchief and marveled how she didn't leave a single black mascara smudge on it. "What time did you arrive?" I asked.
"About 11:30,
she said.
"We had plans to get brunch. He said he had a gift for me. He wouldn't tell me what it was."
It was just after noon now. Even with a late checkout and a do-not-disturb tag, housekeeping would be here soon. I could slip us both out the back door, leave the body for some poor woman to find, call the police, let them process the scene. Eventually the hotel cameras would give us both away, make us look more guilty than if we stayed behind and called them now. For all I knew, she was guilty. But she was my client, and that came first. "Go home," I told her. "Say nothing, take no phone calls except for mine. Do you understand?"
I can't just leave him like this," she insisted. "He was my friend."
"I will handle it," I said, "as respectfully as I can. Walk out of this door and take the stairs. Exit out the back and wait for my call. Call your lawyer, too." She nodded. She leaned in and kissed my cheek.
"Oh, thank you, Mr. Wade," she purred.
She made sure I felt all of her sorrow, all of her pain in that kiss. That was her job, after all. And I had my own job to do. As soon as she was gone, I could feel her lips, even as I pressed my phone to my ear. "Liam," I said when Captain Hollander picked up the phone, "think you need to get some of your boys down here to the Rudiger Hotel." Captain Liam Hollander met me in the hallway. "I'd ask you why you're here," he grumbled, "but I suspect you have no plans to tell me." "Client confidentiality," I recited. "But I'll save you the trip and the phone call. You'll likely find one of my cards in Kyle's wallet. He came by this week."
"Care to tell me why?"
"Client confidentiality." He let out a long sigh. He leaned against the wall and glanced around at the crime scene techs and uniformed police officers and their guests poking their heads out of their rooms.
"Had to miss out on lunch with my kids," he said. "I'm starving. You see a vending machine around here?"
"I think there's one at the end of the hall."
"Why don't you show me?" he asked.
I led him back to the alcove with the ice machine. He stuck a couple of bucks in the machine and got a chocolate bar.
I'm going to tell you this because the family's going to bury us, he said, peeling back the wrapper. I just want a witness for when they force us to change our reports. One word of this gets out, and you'll never get anything from me again.
I wouldn't dare, I said. He chewed thoughtfully.
He was hanging in his closet, he said. Necktie, cigarette burns all over him. Dirty magazines open in front of him. Looks like an accident.
An accident, a suicide, or a staging to look like either one. Either way, no one would ever know. The Fontaines would cover it up with their flowery language of died suddenly overnight. And I might have just let our beautiful murderer slip right out the door. I wasn't even sure I had her real name. She knew more than she was letting on. A woman always did.
What kind of cigarettes did you find at the scene? I asked. I was always a Lucky's kind of man myself.
Winston Gold's here, he replied. God, I haven't had a cigarette in 22 years. Think the last time I had a smoke was the morning of my wedding. Wife made me quit.
I quit when my niece was born, I said. 18 years. I think the techs would notice if we slipped a few out of the pack.
He laughed. Probably not, he said. Except we didn't find the pack. Or any cigarette butts. If he was playing with fire, he did it before he got there. There's no smoking allowed in any of these rooms.
He might have been discovered earlier if someone smelled smoke, I replied. Do me a favor and send over those reports when you get a chance. Sure enough, the papers only printed Kyle's obituary. No story about cigarette-burn body found hanging in a pricey hotel closet. Money can buy a lot of silence when it's funneled down through new ambulances and park benches and scholarship for STEM programs. As promised, I got the files from Hollander. Asphyxiation. Body had been cold for a few hours. The hotel manager said Kyle had checked in the night before and nothing else, citing customer privacy. No one complained about noise or cigarette smoke. In a hotel like that, I doubted anyone complained about anything, unless the housekeeper didn't come fast enough.
Mind if I take a look? Valerie asked.
Well, they're pretty gruesome, I warned.
This isn't the first time this has happened, she said. One of Gina's customers died like this. His mom found him. Oh, it was pretty awful.
I passed her the folder. I thought I'd spare the housekeeper that particular trauma, I said. She settled into the blue chair to read.
Must not have been that good a time,
she commented after a minute.
No presence of, completion.
I took the folder back from her. I hadn't picked up on that particular detail. Good catch, I said. Got a theory?
I think someone else hung him up and staged it, like it was self-inflicted.
So I wasn't alone in thinking that. What throws me is that there aren't any cigarettes in the room, I said.
You think Miss Ridgmond took them with her when she left?
I hadn't spoken to her since I saw her at the hotel. I don't think she could rig him up there by herself, but maybe the game got out of hand and she panicked.
Well, explains why she called you instead of the cops.
Meaning?
Meaning she's playing you, Martin,
she said.
She comes in here with her long lashes and her sotto voce and that Dita Von Tesse waistline, and she's got you throwing yourself in front of the cops trying to protect her. I think, at the very least, she knows why Kyle got killed.
Maybe she did. I'd know more when I called her, or I might get nothing but an empty line and a check that bounced like a rubber ball. The phone rang. Valerie reached for it and gave her usual greeting. She lifted her eyes to meet mine and smirked. Just one moment, Ms. Richmond, she said.
She put the call on hold and passed me the receiver without another word.
Miss Richmond, I said, I was planning on calling you this afternoon.
Mr. Wade, she cooed in my ear, I have something you might like to see.
Miss Richmond lived in a large Victorian on the edge of Center City, the last of the houses on the block that hadn't been carved up into offices or apartments. Her stairs were immaculately cleared of the overnight snowfall. I suspected the Raines College boys who lived next door fought over which one of them got that job. I rapped the antique brass knocker twice. She answered the door in leggings and a cream-colored sweater with a shawl collar and an hourglass fit. She escorted me into the living room and offered me coffee. I accepted before I could stop myself. She went to the kitchen and returned with a French press on an enameled tray. She handed me a bone-white cup without even asking how I took my coffee.
"I'm sorry I haven't called before today," she said. "I saw the story in the paper and I didn't feel safe. If his family was going to frame his death like that, I was worried what they might do if I contested it. And then I received this in the mail this morning. I knew I had to call you immediately."
She removed a long manila envelope from behind a rose-colored velvet cushion and handed it to me. There was no return address, and the label was printed out. Inside was a stack of photos of her, leaving the hotel, shopping for groceries, entering her home. Only her high heels gave away that these were taken on different days.
"Kind of you to assume I didn't take these," I murmured.
"I would have noticed you right away," she said. "I like your aftershave. I've always found sandalwood to be both calming and arousing."
I cleared my throat, took a sip of coffee. Black, just the right amount of sugar. How did she know?
"Have you noticed anyone following you?" I asked. "Suspicious car parked outside, anything like that?"
"I haven't," she said. "But you understand that I can't have someone taking photos of my friends when they come by to visit."
I got up, and I went to the large picture window facing the street. I pushed aside the thick velvet drapes. A jogger went past and gazed at the fitness tracker on his wrist. A pizza driver drove to the frat house and got out of his car with a stack of boxes. "Boys next door bother you at all?"
"Never once," she said. "I usually stop by on move-in day with a tray of lasagna, welcome them to the neighborhood, let them know what my expectations are for their behavior. They've always been very good to me."
I took out the photo of her climbing her steps and tried to approximate the angle it was taken from. The church across the street would offer a certain amount of cover for our intrepid photographer, angled himself behind the hydrangeas. "Have there been any other notes, phone calls?"
"Nothing," she said. "But Kyle's funeral is Thursday. I was hoping you'd come with me. For protection? Whoever sent these is watching me, Mr. Wade, and I don't like to be watched."
"Don't go to that funeral," I said, standing up. "In fact, you may want to leave town for a few days just to be safe."
She looked at me as though I'd thrown paint on her sofa. "He was my friend," she said softly. "I want to say goodbye to him."
"I'm not a bodyguard," I said. "And I'm no good to you if either of our photos end up splashed across the front page. Give me the photos and let me know if others arrive. In the meantime, cancel any other appointments you have planned. You need to lie low. Do you mind if I look around?"
"Oh, by all means," she offered. "You'll find that there are several bedrooms, detective, depending on what sort of scene you're looking for." If I was being played, I had to admit I was enjoying the game. "Do you smoke, Ms. Richmond?" I asked.
"I do not," she said. "I prefer to keep things more sterile than that. I have a few pokers and a brand with my initials."
"That one was a gift from a friend." She paused for a sip of her coffee. "Besides, Kyle wasn't into that sort of thing. Any of it."
"You don't think Kyle's death was an accident?" I murmured.
She shook her head. "That's what really scares me about all of this. And now these photos, I'm not entirely sure what they mean except to intimidate me, and I can't think of anyone who might want to do that."
I suspected the list of people who might want to intimidate her was long. Payday lawyers, nosy executives, furious wives, vice squad goons trying to pad their numbers now that the cold weather forced the girls who worked the riverfront in the music box district to move indoors for the winter. But a setup requires more than one participant. If Kyle's death was declared an accident, then setting up Ms. Richardson was moot. It was too early to know if she was named in the will unless Kyle told them. And hiring some Raines College photojournalist to take a few non-incriminating pictures would be a pretty small step to take, especially when you're as rich as the Fontaines. "I still think you should get out of town," I said. "Just for a few days. Go to a spa, turn off your phone, pay in cash. Come back when everything has settled down."
"I'll take that under careful consideration," she said, rising off the couch. "In the meantime, may I show you around?"
Kyle's sister and brother were waiting for me when I got to the office the next day. Andre looked like the type who'd tortured animals for fun. A long, thin face, and hollow eyes, and a mouth that sat on his face like someone had painted it there. Can't get smile lines if you never smile. Deborah had the same blank face, poised and exquisite, like a department store mannequin, but her Chanel No. 5 couldn't hide the nervous scent of cigarettes in her hair. I've dealt with plenty of rich clients. Not here so much, but plenty of them came through the doors during my time at the Hartford Agency in New York City. The wealthy have a different type of paranoia, the knowledge that money can never truly buy security. Their spouses still cheat, their accountants still embezzle, their children still get addicted to drugs. They're no happier than the rest of us. Money just pays for the illusion that they are. I gave them a set of condolences they already had copies of. "We found your card among our brother's possessions," Andre said. "We'd like to know what kind of work you were doing for him."
"I'm afraid that's protected under client confidentiality," I said. "Anything else I can help you with?"
"We'd hate to get our lawyers involved," Andre said.
"So would I," I replied. "It would be a waste of your attorney's time, and mine."
"Martin," Deborah said, "our brother took several things that did not belong to him, and we would like them back."
I didn't like the way she said my name. I'd gotten spoiled hearing Ms. Richmond purr it. Most people call me Mr. Wade until I give them permission to call me by my first name, but she went straight for it, like a flesh wound. I doubted she'd like it very much if I did the same.
"Such as?"
"For starters, a coat that belonged to our grandmother," Andre said. "Silver fox fur, as well as some documents related to land holdings."
Kyle had been dead for less than a week, and already they were squabbling over rags and real estate.
"Any proof that the coat belonged to you?" I asked.
"It didn't belong to him," she shot back.
"The paperwork is more important," Andre said. "Our brother suffered from considerable depression, anxiety, paranoia, and bouts of mania. We believe he distributed these documents, and the coat in one of these states, then killed himself in shame when he realized, well, what he had done. The coroner said his death was an accident. A gift to a grieving family. It sounded like a cover-up to me. The truth was better gossip fodder than a planned departure. But if the coroner was willing to give them a gift, I could only imagine what the newspapers might wrap up in Christmas paper. All we're asking is that you track these things down and return them to us, Andre said. That is your profession, isn't it? Even if I could, I wouldn't. I made a mental note to check with Miss Ridgmond about the story behind the coat, but that was as far as I was taking any of it. That's where you'll need your attorneys, I said. They'll know better than I would about retrieving any documents. As for the coat, keep an eye on pawn shops and vintage stores, but you might have to be content with the memories. Deborah stood up. Her brother followed.
Thank you for your time, Martin,
she said in a voice that should have left frost on the inside of my windows. Good luck, I said, and again my condolences. I saw them both to the door. I waited until I couldn't hear their footsteps in the stairs anymore. Go ahead and bill them, I said to Valerie.
I thought consultations were free,
she said. They are, I replied, but they can afford it. Kyle's funeral was a private affair, but judging by the cars lined up outside the church, it was one with a high cost of admission. I got Valerie and myself each a cup of coffee and gawked from the parking space in front of the library. I saw Liam go inside. I was hoping I wouldn't.
Well, makes sense, Valerie said. The Fontaines give a lot of money to the police department. They're very law and order types.
I didn't reply. I was still thinking about my conversation with Liam at the crime scene. In case this gets covered up, and now here he was, making nice with the same family who tied his hands. Something didn't make sense. Something was missing. Oh, I saw Miss Richmond get out of a black car at the corner. She was dressed in a long-line skirt suit and black heels, a large leather bag dangling from her arm. Even if I hadn't been looking for her, I wouldn't have been able to miss her. I nearly got hit by an SUV crossing the street to intercept her before she slipped inside the church. "You're not supposed to be here," I hissed. She smiled like a poisonous snake.
"I received another set of photos," she said, reaching into her bag. "I wanted whoever sent them to know that I won't be blackmailed."
"There's a time and a place for everything," I said, "and this is neither of them." If she had been watched, the last place I wanted to take her was my office. I needed some place where the three of us wouldn't stand out, some place public. Flower House fit the bill. It was outside the city limits, a quick bite for the girls who worked the clubs on either end of the strip mall. And Mali didn't talk to cops. I'd seen her refuse to even serve them if they came in uniform. We ordered two bowls of noodles and Thai iced teas. Ms. Richardson peeled off her velvet gloves with the aching precision of a burlesque dancer. She reached into her purse and took out another envelope.
"This series has co-stars," she said as she handed it to me.
"Co-stars and plenty of them. All types, suits to jeans, but it didn't matter what they were wearing. What mattered was that I could see their faces. And if I could see their faces, so could the police, the papers, and their wives."
"Well, good thing you keep your drapes drawn," Valerie murmured. "These could be a lot more explicit."
"When did they arrive?" I asked.
"This morning."
"Ugh." I handed them back to her. "How far do these go back?"
She flipped through the stack and placed one on the coffee table. "This is the oldest," she said.
about 6 weeks ago.
That meant whoever had her under surveillance had been doing it since before Kyle's death. Did Kyle ever talk to you about a will? I asked.
He did, she said. I recommended someone he could see to draft one, someone away from his family. But if you're asking what he left me, I assure you, I wasn't in it.
So why did he need it done by someone else? Valerie asked.
He left all of his assets to various charities, she said. Real charities, not the tax write-offs his family operates. A coding camp, an animal shelter, a food pantry, you know, that sort of thing.
Certainly nothing worth blackmailing her over. The coat, I said. I need you to tell me how you acquired it.
Well, I told you it was a gift, she said. Earlier this month, he said he saw it in an antique shop and said it reminded him of me.
He lied to you, I said. His siblings were in my office, said the coat belonged to their family. Do you have any proof otherwise?
I don't, she said. If it's a problem, I can give it back. I'm sure I've got mink around somewhere I can wear instead.
I envied that mink, but it wasn't the coat that bothered me. Did he give you anything else? I asked. Real estate documents, any sort of paperwork?
She shook her head. I wouldn't know what to do with them if he did, she said. I own my home and have no intention of being a landlord elsewhere.
How was his relationship with his family?
Kyle didn't like them very much, she said. He understood that he had a power and privilege as his birthright, but he had no desire to acquire any more of either. If that made him a dilettante, he didn't care. He was very shy and very kind, and saw his siblings as ruthless and vicious. I'm not surprised they're trying to track down something as small as an old coat. They only want something they're told they can't have. I have the coat in my car, Mr. Wade, and you are welcome to take it. I don't want it any more.
That wasn't what I was after, but when I dropped her off, it's what I left with, on a satin padded hanger. I carried it to the car like a sleeping child. I had a bitter taste in my mouth. She was the kind of woman who made every man who crossed her path into a knight. Except for me, I felt like the jester on the march to the guillotine. Back at the office, I spread the new set of photos on my desk. I wasn't sure what I was looking for, or if some primal part of me wanted another excuse to look at her, like a kid who'd found his father's old Playboy stashed in a vent. The photos were time-stamped, likely printed at a kiosk where no one else would see what the photographer was doing. I laid them out end to end, hour to hour, until I had a timeline. The day of Kyle's murder showed her getting in a car at 11:07 a.m., presumably on her way to where she would find his body. I recognized a few of her clients. No wonder this was all getting hushed up. Whoever hired this photographer had enough information to control the whole city like Batman's villain. But I suspected whoever hired him had that power before these photos were printed.
"Quite the spread," Valerie said. Pretty sure one of those was my high school choir teacher.
Surprised he can afford her, I said, on a teacher's salary. She snickered.
Did a little digging on the will, she said. Nothing yet filed. I get that it's early, but given how eager they were to get their hands on whatever documents they thought he had, you'd think they would have filed it before the body got cold.
Unless it would raise too much suspicion, I replied. As far as I can tell, we've got three cases. Kyle's death, the photos, and the missing coat and documents.
I thought you were taking on the... I thought you weren't taking on the Fontaine's case, Valerie said. Oh, not for them, I said. But I'd be a fool not to investigate these documents, especially if they're tied to the photos.
Question is, why send the photos at all? She said. They haven't asked her for any money, so it's not blackmail.
Well, maybe not for her, but there was a reason Kyle's death was declared an accident. I stuffed all the photos back in her case file. All except for one. That one was my ticket to my next destination. District Attorney Jack Lorenz didn't look happy to see me. I carried the manila folder in my hand like the nuclear football. I didn't want to defuse its power. We settled into our chairs. I put the photo on his desk. He let out a thick sigh and picked it up.
"Where'd you get this?" he spat. "Doesn't matter," I said. "What matters is that I have it, which means someone else does too. Isn't Judge Wicker married?" He didn't answer that. "What do you want? You know Kyle Fontaine's death wasn't an accident." "Of course it wasn't," Jack snorted. "But our only suspect has her boot on our throat, literally in some cases. The Fontaines asked me to hush it up. Guess they'd rather see their brother's killer go free than bring up any shame to their family when he was found cavorting with a lady of ill repute. He got kinky. Things got out of hand. It happens. It just that most of the time we don't know about it." So she had been a suspect at one time. I pulled out a second photo. "Consider her cleared," I said, pointing to the timestamp. "But whoever took these photos might not be." He eyed me suspiciously. "Why are you on this?" he asked. "Does she have one on you in there, too?" I ignored him. "If you really thought she killed him," I said, "you would have arrested her already. Gossip be damned. But this is a cover-up, Jack. The judge and the coroner both. I just don't want to see you get burned when all this blows up."
"Don't tell me you've got the match lit." "I'm protecting my client," I said. "Someone is stalking her. She's received two sets of these photos so far."
"So, go protect her," he said. "I'm sure you're up to the task." This wasn't like Jack. I secretly wondered if he would show up in the next set of photos. Someone had his hands tied, and it wasn't Judge Wicker or the Fontaines. My phone rang as I crossed the parking lot. Valerie.
"Our photographer just parked," she hissed. "White male, blonde hair under a ski cap, mid-30s, driving a champagne-colored sedan, parked in front of the frat house. I wrote down the plate number."
It would take me 10 minutes to get across town. Here's hoping he had plans to hang around.
"Good," I said, getting in my car. "Keep your eyes on him. I'll be there as quickly as I can."
"What if he leaves?"
The last thing I need was for her to get in a car chase. "You stay put," I said. "I'm on my way." The photographer tried to run when he spotted me getting out of my car, but the sidewalks were icy, and he was unsure of himself. I caught up to him quickly, grabbed him by his collar, and hauled him to a slick stop.
"Who hired you?" I demanded.
He spat something I wouldn't repeat.
"Why are you taking photos of this house?" I tried.
"I like the architecture," he said. "Plenty of other Victorians in this neighborhood," I said. "But I doubt I'll see any of them if I look on your camera. Now who hired you?"
"I'm freelance."
I was getting sick of this smart-mouth answers. "Did the Fontaines hire you to take blackmail photos of the occupant of this house?"
"If you're cops, I want a lawyer."
"He's not a cop," Valerie said, "but we can get them involved if you'd like."
"It's legal to stand on the street and take pictures."
"Once they see what's on your card, they won't care if it's legal or not," I said. "Best case scenario, they accidentally drop your camera when they arrest you. Worst case scenario, You wind up with a stalking charge, a restraining order, and a busted camera. Leave her alone. He shook me off.
Fine,
he said. I'll lay off the photos. Not good enough, I said. Tell us who sent you.
Tell me who you work for.
Well, he had me there. I had no legal grounds to hold him, no way to force him to talk. Delete what's on your card now, I said.
Ah, to hell with you.
You want me to call the cops, I repeated, because I'm happy to get all this on the record. I'm sure your boss, whoever they are, will be you too. He sucked on his lip. He turned on his camera, and I watched the screen as he erased everything. I knew he had plenty more at home, but I couldn't have concerned myself with that now. We had his license plate. Valerie snapped a photo of him with her phone. He wouldn't be any more trouble for Ms. Richmond. That was one thing off my to-do list. At home, I tried to keep busy. I ran 3 miles on the treadmill and struggled through every one of them. I burned my dinner. I was 15 minutes late for every movie on TV, and every note I tried on my piano sounded sour. Everything was wrong about my case, and I couldn't figure out why or what the hell I was still doing. I couldn't stop thinking about Ms. Richmond. My whole car smelled like rose oil. My doorbell rang. I got up and answered it, and she was standing there, hair wet from the rain. Before I could ask what she was doing or how she tracked me down, she threw herself into my arms and pressed her mouth against mine. She tasted like cinnamon. I knew it was wrong, but I was just as weak as any other man she had in her grasp. I was just another client to her, and I didn't care. I let her devour me. The doorbell was as stuck as I was, shrieking and shrill, a radius blast warning I had every intention of ignoring. She leaned in close, all whispered in my ear.
"We'll always have Paris."
I snapped awake. I fumbled for the remote and turned off the TV. Of course, that's what I got for trying to watch Casablanca at this time of night. But the doorbell didn't stop.
"I can see your light on," I heard Valerie. "Let me in."
I answered the door. She had her laptop bag slung over her shoulder.
"Sorry to come by so late,"
she said.
"But I found a few things you might be interested in. Can I come in?"
I ran my hand across my face. I could still feel my heart pounding. Sure, I mumbled. "Let me put on some coffee."
"The will was filed yesterday afternoon," Valerie said as we got settled at the dining room table. "I ran one more search after you left for the day, just in case. He didn't leave Miss Richmond, or anyone, a single thing. His estate is to be liquidated, and all cash assets are divided between the library, the animal shelter, and scholarships at his alma mater."
"Well, it explains why the siblings came to me to try to track down anything of value."
"Well, not quite," Valerie said. "I did some deeper research. Growing up, we were always told the mythology of the Fontaines, the radio factory, the hospital, the music hall. But there's mythology, and then there's straight-up lies. Take Ambrose Fontaine."
She pulled up a folder on her phone.
"The library wouldn't let me copy this. She said the book was too old. But I think the fact that great-granddaddy Ambrose ran guns to Confederate soldiers is probably closer to the truth. Jump ahead in time a little, and granddaddy Aaron was a strikebreaker who ran liquor on the side, moderate mob ties, although those broke up in the late 50s at the Appalachian meeting."
"Mob ties don't carry as much weight as they used to," I said. "It's basically a party story at this point."
She grinned. "But it got me thinking. What if there's something more current? Something no one else knows yet? Maybe it's not about the documents Kyle took. It's about what they could reveal about the family," I finished.
Miss Richmond answered the door in silk pajamas.
I don't normally take callers this late in the evening, she said, but I'm always happy to see you, Mr. Wade.
I didn't have time for her games. I held out the fox fur coat. I need to see every gift Kyle gave you. She opened the door wider.
Give me a moment, she said, while I gather them all up.
We waited in the dining room while she went upstairs. There were purses, a pair of boots with platform heels, a teddy bear almost as large as Valerie. I tried to be careful with all of them. I wielded a pocket knife with the precision of a surgeon. The purses were lined with carefully folded photocopies. The heels were hollow and held a USB drive. There was a checkbook sewn into the inside of the teddy bear. And the new lining of the coat covered a German label, complete with a swastika.
I don't understand, she said.
Kyle gave them to you for safekeeping, I said. He was worried something might happen to him, so he gave them to the one person he knew he could trust.
Do you think that person killed him?
I'm sure of it. I left a message for Andre and Deborah that I had retrieved the coat and they could come by my office in the afternoon to pick it up. They returned my call immediately. I spread the coat out across my desk like an autopsy. I wanted them to see what I had found. Deborah launched into a dramatic series of sobs when she saw the torn lining.
Oh, where did you find it? She asked.
Around, I said. And I believe I have the documents you were looking for as well, but I think you'll want to sit down when I bring those out. Andre went pale. He eased himself onto my sofa. Deborah tried to play it cool as she sat in the chair. I took out everything I had, every piece that Kyle had hidden in the gifts he gave. Valerie had already made copies tucked into a safe, and the originals were in there too, ready to be handed over to the proper authorities. Your grandfather sold radio parts to the Nazis, I said, and his cousin sent this coat as a gift. That cousin was Laurel Fontaine, wife of Austin Fontaine, both American Nazi supporters. I don't see how any of this is your business, Andre snapped. It wasn't, I said, until you murdered your brother. Neither of them spoke. That left me room to do so. Kyle was going to expose you, I said. Your whole family. He spent years gathering the evidence against you, all of you, waiting for someone he could trust enough with it. And he did. He gave Miss Richmond everything. At first, you didn't notice the paperwork gone missing. You didn't notice that he hacked your files and broke into company computers and borrowed old photo albums you thought were well hidden. But then he took the coat. Then you figured it out, and it was a line too far, which is really saying something, considering how many lines the Fontaines have crossed. We've donated well over $1 million to the Holocaust Memorial. I know, I said. There's considerable exhibit named for you. Not anymore. The photos are already in the mail, so your time is better spent working up a press release than trying to stop their arrival. There's your father's work, of course, selling guns to terrorist organizations, but there are folks in Washington, D.C. who will handle that, which leaves only you two. Up until now, it's been minor financial misbehavings, but you couldn't risk anything exposing the rest of your family. So when you found out what Kyle did, you followed him to the hotel. You knew he indulged in certain practices. So you drugged him, tortured him, burned him with a cigarette in your purse, and finally hanged him in a closet to make it look like an accident, and you were willing to let his girlfriend take the fall. She wasn't his girlfriend, Andre said. She was a dominatrix, a sex worker. She was his friend, I corrected him. She cared a hell of a lot more than his family did. Deborah didn't seem fazed.
You don't have any proof, she said.
The hotel cameras will place you at the crime scene at the time of his death, I said. And your hired photographer accidentally gave your patsy an alibi.
I've already told Captain Hollander to get a warrant to retrieve the rest of the pictures. And on the off chance the district attorney can't make a case, well, the newspapers will finish you off. I've gone ahead and notified them, too. Andre started to open his mouth to protest, but Deborah stopped him with her hand on his arm. She stood and straightened her lapels. "You'll be hearing from our lawyers, Martin." "Give them my direct line," I said. "Or better yet, have them call the DA. He'll take it from here." The arrest of Deborah and Andre Fontaine made the national news. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the front cover of People magazine, a sleazy headline in the Daily News. Statements had to be issued by museums and foundations condemning their actions. No one mentioned my client. She, like me, would always stay inside the shadows. Miss Richmond came by my office when the headlines died down and Valerie was out to lunch.
"I went by Kyle's grave," she told me. "I took flowers. Daisy's his favorite. I miss him terribly, you know."
"I'm sure you do," I said. "He seemed like quite the guy."
"He was," she said. "Even better than I knew. I want to thank you for your work on this case."
"It's what I do." She set an envelope on my desk. She leaned in and kissed me on the cheek.
"You know where to find me," she said. "If you ever get lonely."
"You know where to find me," I said, "if you ever need a detective." She smiled and left me with the scent of rose oil and the fading sting of a kiss. It isn't all dames in brassard doubloons, I once told Valerie, but maybe once in a while there was room for one of those things. Valerie came back half an hour later.
"Was Miss Richmond here?" she asked. "I can smell her perfume."
"She was," I said. "Or maybe we both just dreamed her."
Well, that was a good one. I hope you enjoyed it. It turns out our first story is also our last story. Thank you so much for tuning into the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here asking you to tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.